Behold the dark grey man. Catherine Campbell's father, Sholto Douglas, was the hero of her childhood, an unconventional senior commander in the Royal Air Force, described as a gloriously contentious character. Following childhood abandonment and poverty, Sholto rose to the ranks of the fledgling RAF in the First World War before taking on the crucial role in the Second as head of fighter command and going on to serve in Germany as military governor in the war's devastating aftermath. Catherine has put together a book called Behold the Dark Grey Man of the Effects of the War. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Catherine Campbell. Catherine, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us this morning. Explain a little bit for those who don't know about your father's role during the war and also what his role in Germany after the war.
Right, well, during the war, he started the war as assistant chief of the air staff and then in April 1940 moved to deputy chief of the air staff. And so he was in that role during the Battle of Britain. And he had a very, very heavy workload because the chief of the air staff, Newell, by that time was suffering himself from overwork and strain. And I suspect, actually, that Newell himself was suffering from what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder. So my father, in effect, had double the workload. He got involved in a huge controversy in the Battle of Britain over the Big Wing, and that's what a lot of people remember him for. He got into arguments with Dowding and also Park over whether the whole Big Wing thing was whether you should meet incoming enemy aircraft, swarms of incoming enemy aircraft, with small groups, small forces, as Dowding and Park were doing, or whether you should meet them with equally large numbers of forces, many squadrons formed up into a big wing. And that was the controversy. At the end of the Battle of Britain, my father actually replaced Dowding as Commander-in-Chief of Fighter Command, and he was in that position for 2 years. Then he went on to become Commander-in-Chief of Middle East Command for a year. And then after that, really his most successful posting, really, was as Commander-in-Chief of Coastal Command from the beginning of 1944 until the end of the war. Thereafter, he went in July 1945 to become Commander-in-Chief of the British Air Forces of Occupation in post-war Germany. And then in May 1946, he took over as military governor of the British zone in Germany and commander of all the armed forces there.
I mean,
so that was his trajectory, if you like, through the war.
An illustrious career. And of course, if I'm correct, he'd served in the First World War. Had he served in the First World War as well?
Yes, he had indeed. He enlisted in the First World War, at the beginning of the First World War, in the Royal Horse Artillery. And after a few months, transferred to the Royal Flying Corps, where he was an observer.
Right.
Then he trained as a pilot in 1915, became a squadron commander of number 43 squadron in 1916, and then in 1917, following a very bad aircraft accident, after he'd recovered from that, in 1917 he became commanding officer of number 84 squadron.
So
you know, he was beginning to shine, if you like, at the beginning of the first, by the end of the First World War.
I mean, it's an incredible career trajectory, and researching, you know, his background and the plaudits to the man are quite something. Tell me a little bit about Archie, his brother.
Right. Well, Archie was his youngest brother, and he Sholto and Archie had a really good relationship. They absolutely adored each other. I think because they were more alike in character than they were with the middle brother, whose name was Bobby. And they had, the three boys had an absolutely penurious childhood from when my father, Sholto, was six and his little brothers were 5 and 3 because their father deserted the family and left them basically with nothing. And they had to go and live with their mother's parents in Tooting in South London. And my father, as happens in many families, I think, where this kind of thing happens, my father took over, if you like, caring for his two little brothers. And so they formed very close bonds. And in the war, Archie signed up later than Sholto, but he went into the Royal Field Artillery. Then when my father was a flying instructor briefly back at Montrose in Scotland, he took Archie for a joyride when in a BE-2C aircraft when Archie went to stay with him for a few days. And Archie said, "That's the life for me. I'm going into the Royal Flying Corps." So he joined the Royal Flying Corps, but and he was an observer, but very, very sadly, on the 16th of October 1916, he was shot down with his pilot when they were in a BE-2C. They were shot down by German anti-aircraft fire, and both of them were killed. And my father felt absolutely decimated by this. And also, it was made worse by his mother, who said to him, if you had not joined the RFC and persuaded Archie to do so too, Archie would still be here today. Oof. And the tragic thing was that Archie was her favourite son.
Mm. I mean, so, that's one of the things, isn't it? I mean, we'll talk about what happened, you know, when you were a child with your father, but if you think about those generations of the First World War, those who survived, those who had been shell shocked, and those who said, you know, I should not be here, I should be, you know, with my brothers in Flanders, and then and then you have something like your own mother blaming you for your sibling's death.
Yes, exactly. And she kept on going on about it, you know, till the end of her life. And my father, I remember when I was a child, Sholto had pictures of his brothers, Archie and Bobby, on his desk till the end of his life.
Did Bobby survive the war, by the way? Was Bobby?
He survived the war, but then he died in India in 1926. Basically, after the war, he went and read for the Oriental Languages Tripos at Cambridge. They were all really clever, these boys.
Right.
And he read for the Oriental Languages Tripos and got a first, and then went to India in the Indian Civil Service. And in 1926, very sadly, he died, supposedly of cholera. But in fact, his widow, Gloria, thought that he might have been poisoned, whether she was just being florid. But he was a magistrate in the United Provinces. And the thing was that Gloria thought that a resentful somebody who'd been at the receiving end of one of Bobby's handing down of sentences might have poisoned him.
Right.
So we don't know. We just don't know exactly how he died.
So tell me a little bit then about after the war, and you had, if you like, a childhood in the military. I mean, when did your father first start to show signs that perhaps something wasn't quite right?
Right. Well, I suppose it was really obvious after his second stroke, which happened in 1963. His first stroke was in 1962, and he suffered some physical impairment from that. But from 1963 onwards, he was okay up until his retirement in April 1964. But thereafter, we began to see that something was wrong. And he became very, very tearful. And I remember Churchill's funeral, you know, his big official funeral in January 1965. And I was sitting watching the funeral with my father, who we used to sit together a lot in the dining room in our house. And the tears just poured down my father's face. And I didn't really understand then. What I understand now was that Churchill had been his strong supporter all the way through the war, even when others had got into conflict and with my father and had doubted him. Churchill never doubted him. And he became more emotionally labor, you know, more easily angry, more easily anxious, more easily fearful, more easily bursting into tears. All of those things happened. And then a little while after, we realized that he was having nightmares. And after some of those nightmares, he used to sleepwalk. And that's how the book opens, because it opens with one of his sleepwalking episodes. So, you know, it, in a way, it was a gradual thing, both mental and physical deterioration. But the thing was, he understood it. He knew. And he used to cry and say, "My brain's going soft," which for somebody who had had such a stellar career and also who was so very clever, that was a terrible thing to happen to him.
I mean, this is the thing with dementia is it's, you know, it's a gradual process. It's by degrees as the faculties go, and it's the most horrible illness for everybody involved. But also, you know, the
It wasn't just dementia, though.
I know.
It was complicated with PTSD.
Which was just, I was just about to come on to that, you see, because the thing was because of his PTSD. And it's an interesting one because we seem to think now PTSD after the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, both the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War, we seem to think that this as something that happens in the white hot environment of combat and the horrendous scenes that people will see, colleagues being killed, colleagues being horribly wounded, you know, the cacophony of war. Your father was making decisions on a tactical level, both during and after the war, but, you know, with the RAF, that he knew were going to be sending young men to perilous missions from which lots of them wouldn't come back. And it's never really been discussed, the effect that that has on a person giving those orders. I mean, it's very easy to say, to think, oh, well, and to think almost sort of, you know, General Haig in the First World War, sitting miles behind in comfort, sending young men to their deaths. But your father obviously wasn't like that. And nobody's ever looked until now onto the effect that had the burden on his shoulders.
That is true. And, you know, there's very little in the literature on leaders having PTSD. And what are the consequences of sending young men out knowing that they will never return? And in a way, you know, it is like signing their death warrant. And, you know, because of the guilt that their mother fastened upon Sholto, he must have felt like he'd signed Archie's death warrant. So you know, there is that. But there is almost nothing in the literature about leaders having PTSD. There is almost more amongst the First World War psychiatrists and physicians and neurologists than there is amongst the Second World War psychiatrists. You know, people in the First War, people like Rivers and Myers and Burley, they sort of understood, you know, and actually Lord Moran, Churchill's doctor, he said that very thing, that he sent young men out in the First World War knowing that some of them would never return. And had he made the right decision, you know, by passing his unit as fit to go over the top.
Yeah.
But there is very, very little after the Second World War, and actually very little since. And what happens with senior commanders or commanders in general when they experience things like that? Obviously, they don't talk about it. Hardly anybody ever talks about it, even now. And they just store all that stuff up. And so you see the consequences of all that repression in old age veterans.
Yeah.
And there was a very interesting study done in the States looking at veterans who'd experienced trauma, and they did, and they were also they'd had the diagnosis of dementia fastened upon them, but the investigators in this study realized that when they addressed the trauma, the dementia symptoms disappeared. Which makes you wonder, or at least they got better, and in many cases they did disappear altogether, which makes you wonder how many people there are sitting in old people's homes or wherever with dementia who are actually traumatized and nobody's addressed that.
Mm. And also, I suppose, the other thing is the fact that, you know, we talk about... the people you mentioned in the First World War sending people to their deaths and signing death warrants. But, I mean, your father had to, in post-war Germany, he had to actually sign real death warrants.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I describe in the book what it was like when I saw my father's signature on a death warrant. And it was shocking. You know, they're there in the National Archives, but most people would not ever imagine their parent or their father signing anything like that.
These would be death warrants for presumably Nazis or
some Nazis, yeah. A lot of displaced persons. Because the other thing that I may, and I spend an awful lot of time on this in the book, the other thing is that post-war Germany was an absolute and utter nightmare. It was a chaos. It was chaos. And people have absolutely forgotten that. And there were displaced persons roaming the country, robbing German citizens in isolated farms, holding them up, murdering their German captors or their German oppressors, because a lot of these people had been brought into Germany as slave labor. And now the war was ended, they were turning on their captors, their oppressors, and murdering them. And they had been brutalized, and they had lost everything. And so, and they'd been brutalized, I think, to an extent that most of us would not understand unless we'd been in a war zone. And, you know, my father had to sign these death warrants, and he had the most terrible crises of conscience over this. There were some, and I described two Nazi atrocities in the book, where the trials were actually in the British zone.
Right.
And my father was not quite as concerned about signing those death warrants because obviously those people had done appalling things. But even on one group trial where there was the main protagonist, the main defendant, and then six of his accomplices, my father even wondered, oh, perhaps we could commute the sentences of some of these? You know, because unlike the Nazis themselves, he was not the kind of person who was just up for summarily executing everybody. You know, he really wasn't like that. And even at Nuremberg, he had crises of conscience about signing, about hearing the pleas for clemency for the major Nazi war criminals. So he had a lot of crises of conscience. And it's interesting that in his final years, he didn't display the reenactments, you know, the re-experiencing symptoms of PTSD over World War One combat or sending people to their deaths in World War Two, although undoubtedly he was worried about that. No, what the subject of the reenactments when he was old was signing the death warrants. That's what bothered him most. And that would bring us onto another topic entirely if you wanted to discuss it, and that is moral injury.
Well, the thing is, I mean, if you, but just to, I mean, the way that we say, you know, he was there at listening to Nuremberg, and if you think about the impact of the statements at that trial, there had never been a trial like it.
No.
War crimes, crimes against humanity for the first time were heard. The devastating impact that you would have, that your father would have been through, and anybody who was sitting, because we look now through the lens of history, you know, but the impact, and we are in a way, because we have the buffer, if you like, because we know what the Nazis were up to. We know what the German high command had done. But this was being revealed to them, and the sheer horror of what they were hearing would have an impact with anybody with any moral compass whatsoever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I see that in what my father scrawled over the pleas for clemency. And, you know, many people know don't know that there were even pleas for clemency, that these were even submitted on behalf of the Nazi war criminals. And they, the war criminals hired the most erudite lawyers in order to defend them. And the pleas for clemency, although many, well, actually all of them, are outrageous in their assertions after what these people had done, you know, they're also very, very clever. But in the National Archives, there are these documents, there are the pleas, and my father's writing is all over them, in either angry comments in red or blue pencil, or more considered comments in blue Biro, you know.
Yeah.
And he wrote all over them because he was just so appalled at what these people had done. And yes, you're so right. They were these atrocities and war crimes, crimes against humanity, were being revealed in all their horror for the first time. And yet there were these lawyers trying to defend their clients. And, you know, that must in itself have been an extraordinary thing to go through. And my father, unlike the other three military governors who didn't appear to voice many opinions or to have done much preparation, my father actually did the preparation, and he was the only one who actually had a really considered opinion about what should happen to these people.
And what was his considered opinion? Because, I mean, a lot of them, I mean, some of the Nazi high command did get clemency. Speer, of course, famously, Hitler's minister for armaments.
Yes.
Was in Spandau. Hess, of course, famously as well. Goering took his own life. So what was, I mean, because it would be very easy to say, well, they're all Nazis, you know, hang them, shoot them, just get rid of them.
Yeah, well, in fact, that is what Sokolovsky said, you know, Marshal Sokolovsky, the Russian military governor, you know, he said during the meetings, oh, I don't care, you know, just hang them all or whatever.
The Russian experience during the Second World War was entirely different, so you can understand where he was coming from, of course.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know that at Yalta, Stalin had said that 50,000 of the Nazi high command should be summarily liquidated, and Roosevelt had this told him, you know, had a rather sick comment, oh, maybe just 49,000 would do,
right?
You know? And Churchill said he would rather be executed himself rather than be associated with such infamy. So that was where he was coming from. But it is true that there was clemency exercised by the court itself, you know, before the military governors read the pleas for clemency. The justices in the court at Nuremberg had exercised clemency themselves. So some people were acquitted, and some people, well, Speer, absolutely, and I think Baldur von Schirach was the other one. He had his sentence commuted to 20 years. And then there was Dönitz. He only had 10 years, a sentence of 10 years in prison. But my father actually thought that the sentence on Dönitz, Admiral Dönitz, was too lenient. Mm. because of the way he had conducted unrestricted submarine warfare, and he had called for the summary sinking of rescue boats in convoys.
Yes.
Which my father thought obviously was unforgivable.
We're going to, unfortunately, we're going to run out of time. We're going to do what we always call crash the news. Tell me a little bit about the title. What is behind Behold the Dark Grey Man?
Right, well, it is the translation of my father's name in Gaelic.
Ah, okay.
And it comes from a guy called David Hume of Godscroft. He wrote it in a book, although the translation was there before then. But he, in the 17th century, worked for his relative, the 8th Earl of Angus, and he wrote a book about the history of the house and race of Douglas, and it's in there. It's a sort of mythical story in the 9th century to do with the Celtic king, but who said of one of his brave knights, "Who is that man?" And somebody said, "Behold the Black Grey Man."
The book is called Behold the Dark Grey Man.
The Dark Grey Man. Yeah, because I thought Behold the Black Grey Man
yes,
was a little
indeed,
over the top.
Indeed. It's by Catherine Campbell. Catherine, I could have spoken to you for much longer on this, but I'm going to run out of time. If people want to find...
But thank you.
The pleasure has been all mine. He was a fascinating man. It's a fascinating subject. I urge people to go and find more about Sholto Douglas. The book is called Behold the Dark Grey Man. Catherine Campbell, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much too, Giles.